Ever been trapped between your own inspiration and the still small voice and the guidance and direction of a leader that may seem to go contrary to what it is that you were hearing in your heart and in your mind? I think that's the exact battle that was going on in 1837 in Kirtland and in Missouri. Join us today where we talk about the messy middle. That is that time when we have to wrestle between our own heart and sometimes what we're hearing from a leader and decide what we do about it. Thanks for coming. And welcome to another Monday morning Book of Mormon class with Kevin Hinckley. Recorded live, we dive deeply and deliberately into this inspired scripture. How far we get in one class depends a lot on the material and the doctrines left for us by ancient prophets. A single chapter may occupy one class or many. Of course, opinions expressed by the teacher or the class members do not constitute official church doctrines. Join us in this adventure and discover the hidden treasures found within his pages. And now, on to the class. And welcome to another class and a new semester. Obviously, this class that was taught this morning, we had some of our recording equipment that stopped working. So I'm going to get a chance to give the class briefly here on this podcast. So maybe that's an advantage for you because you get to hear it a little bit quicker and get all of the high points faster. So anyway. In today's class, we're going to talk about the great apostasy of 1837 that occurred in, first of all, in Kirtland, Ohio, and then also was happening simultaneously in Missouri and Far West at the same time, and the dual tragedy. If there's a bad two-year stretch for the church, this may have been the worst, where everything hung in the balance. Now, to understand what actually happened in Kirtland, it's important that we kind of draw on from another class that we taught about just a few months ago, because we're going to talk about how members of the church struggled then and now with something we'll call the messy middle, because. And in doing that, we're going to talk about God framing his creation with all kinds of contraries. Now, a contrary is two truths that are both true but seem to be somewhat in opposition to one another, as opposed to a true opposite where things are truly right or wrong. But these two truths are both right, and you're trying to figure out how to balance between the two. For instance, there was going to be a good example of this would be that we're going to have faith versus works. And sometimes we lean a little bit more to the faith and sometimes a little bit more to the works. Think about in terms of creation, where we had the tree of life. Not necessarily in opposition to the tree of knowledge of good and evil, but certainly contrary in that you would lean one way or the other. And these contraries, light and dark, male and female, you start to look into scriptures and you see, we talked about how you see these everywhere, these contraries. Do I lean one way or the other? And actually, it was Joseph Smith who said, actually, by proving contraries, truth is made manifest. So, how do we deal with contraries? Well, we would add to the fact, the idea that any virtue that we have, anything that we think we do well, a strength that we feel like we have, once it's taken to an extreme, actually can become a vice. I can feel good about myself in studying the scriptures and being involved in that, but if I start doing that exclusively all the time and exclude everything else, then that strength, that good thing taken too far, becomes a not good thing. It's nice to have a little bit dessert with a dinner, but if that's all we eat, then we've taken a good thing and it's become a vice to us. Now, why is it such a struggle? Well, because we live in a church of certainty. We like our truths and we like our hard truths. And we talk about how, but what we want is that we want peace. And we tend to frame peace as peace is not, well, we want to call it the absence of conflict. In reality, peace isn't the absence of conflict. Peace is the acceptance that there is conflict. There are contraries. That's why President Nelson keeps talking about that we know that there are disagreements, but we need to learn how to disagree better one with another. Now, why is all this important to talk about contraries in relation to the apostasy of 1837? That's because one of the biggest struggles they had then is the same one that we struggle with a little bit now. And it's this contrary, that we believe as a church in institutional revelation, that God speaks to prophets, that God through inspiration can speak to stake presidents, to bishops, and give them inspiration and guidance and counseling over wards and stakes and the church. At the same time, we also have a belief in personal revelation, that God can speak to us. But that means that at times it sets up the possibility that institutional revelation, like our bishop is saying to do one thing, but we are getting guidance and direction through the still small voice of a personal revelation that might be at odds to that or a little bit different. What happens when the president of the church says one thing and we really feel spiritually drawn to something else, and we're having to wrestle between the two of those? Now, there are going to be some people that say, well, that's not a wrestle. You just follow the prophet, and you won't run into any problems. And I think we have a tendency to move towards that. Follow the prophets. Do what the leaders have told us to do. But remember that any virtue taken too far becomes a vice. What if we always follow the prophets or always follow our bishop or stake president to the exclusion that we don't ever examine our own personal revelation, that our own ability to trust in our own guidance goes away because if we follow the leaders, we can never be wrong. So we're kind of using it as a backstop to avoid making mistakes. By the same token, if we always believe that we need to follow our own truths, our own personal revelation, to the exclusion of never following what the leaders tell us to do, then we can make that personal virtue into a vice by ignoring sound, inspired counsel when it comes into our life because we didn't come up with it. Somewhere in between the two, we're trusting our own counsel and we're mixing it with inspired counsel from leaders and having to move from one side to another from time to time. It's this exact conundrum, do I follow my own counsel or the counsel of a leader, that leads us right into what was occurring in Kirtland and Missouri in 1836, 1837, and into 1838. So we're going to talk today mostly about Kirtland, and then next week we're going to have a class on looking at the Missouri side of the struggle. So let's take the Kirtland side. Shortly after the dedication of the Kirtland Temple, Kirtland began to experience what could only be described as explosive growth. the price of land in and around Kirtland rose by 500%. New converts were coming in, not usually wealthy, but they were coming in from all over, and so there was all kinds of speculation on land, both from members and non-members, about what they were going to charge people coming in to buy farmland and houses. So suddenly we had this hyperinflation going on in and around Kirtland. Added to that, there was a crushing debt in the church in general. The Kirtland Temple had cost somewhere between, it's estimated, somewhere between $12,000 and $15,000 to build. Church didn't have that money. Joseph had borrowed from creditors in New York to try and fund it, and now those notes were coming due. So what does he do? Well, how do you handle the fact that people need to be able to get credit to be able to build things, but the money isn't necessarily available? There are two things that the prophet comes up with. Number one is actually one that you find if you look at D&C section 111, that suddenly from the dedication of the Kirtland Temple that we have in section 110, now a few months later, D&C 111 opens, and of all places, Joseph is writing a revelation from Salem, Massachusetts. And you go, what in the heck is Joseph doing in Salem, Massachusetts? D&C 111. Well, the short answer to that is the fact that that there was a man that had come into Kirtland who said that he knew of a house in Salem where there was buried treasure in the basement of this house, and that all they needed to do was rent this house. They could dig in the basement. They'd be able to find the money. Joseph saw this as an opportunity to get the church out of debt, and so he was willing to take a chance. So they actually did. He took the first presidency. They swung through New York, talked to the creditors, told them that they would take care of the debt, and then made their way up to Salem, Massachusetts, rented the house, only to find nothing there. That's why the beautiful thing about section 111 is that it starts with the idea where the Lord is saying, I'm not altogether unpleased with you being here. The Lord says, there is treasure here, basically, but he says, notwithstanding this folly. It was a folly, it was a mistake to come to Salem, but there is treasure in this place. And as always, it turns out the treasure is the people that are waiting to hear the gospel. So they do a modicum of preaching while they're in Salem. They're able to see some things that are important, but they're soon on their way back. Now, the footing has already been put in place for the other way that they might solve the debt and dilemma, and to get the church and the people out of debt and help them become more prosperous. And that is the idea of starting a bank. And so what they did is they first of all drew up the plans for what would be called, of all things, the Kirtland Safety Society, for something that would turn out not to be safe, but that would be the bank. Now, because banks were requiring reserves that could back whatever loans they were making out, the church actually, with dwindling funds, actually purchased a bank in Monroe, Michigan, the Monroe Bank, to help back up the Kirtland Safety Society. Now, somebody mentioned today, and well put, I thought, why would the people in Monroe sell this bank to the crazy Mormons? Well, it's because they knew that there wasn't a lot of value there, and they were more than happy to sell it to somebody that wanted to buy it. But that particular bank, after they purchase it, actually goes closes, goes bankrupt in October of 1836, and because banks are failing all over the place. We're on our way to what's called the bank panic of 1837, where most banks failed because they were supposed to have good reserves in their coffers. They didn't. And so as they were issuing paper money, bank notes, that really basically had no value. But that's happening. But they go ahead, and on the first week of January 1837, they go ahead and open the Kirtland Safety Society for business. They take in a lot of deposits from some of the more wealthier members, like John Johnson, to fund this. Now, almost immediately, they're going to create these banknotes, but there's a man in Kirtland determined to bring this bank down, and he creates a run on the bank in late January and sues Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon. And he will be a gadfly attacking them, so the bank really never gets off the ground. And by June of 1837, Joseph and Sidney have left the bank, and in fact, in the paper, warning people not to invest in that. Now, that's what's happening, and that's what will actually lead to the beginning of the Great Apostasy in Kirtland, because people feel like they have been lied to by church leaders. Now, at the same time as that's happening, quickly as a teaser for Missouri, the Missouri Saints are growing. There are people moving in, and they are expanding far beyond what the settlers thought that they would be seeing, as more and more Mormons were pouring into, first of all, Caldwell County, then DeWitt County. As they were pouring out of Clay County, the Mormons just seemed to keep on coming, and that was creating rising tensions with them. And so you started to have acts of sabotage going on by the old settlers, and some retribution, as we'll talk next week, coming from the church. But maybe the bigger problem when we look at this is the infighting that happens within church leadership. You had a first presidency of Zion that consisted of David Whitmer as president of the president of Zion, basically. And he and John Whitmer, his counselor, and W.W. Phelps felt like they were equal to the first presidency under Joseph Smith in Kirtland. And so they were busy bringing in money and people as they were moving in and buying properties and doing it the way that they wanted to do it. The infighting comes when two apostles, Thomas Marsh and David Patton, show up from Kirtland and begin to push back and have conflicts with this first presidency in Zion. And it gets to a point where the apostles go ahead and evict and push out, to their great consternation, the first presidency in Zion. And that felt like it's unjust and unfair. But in order to win them over, there's all kinds of allegations about malfeasance of spending and really kind of besmirching the characters of David Whitmer, one of the original three witnesses, and his brother, and W.W. Phelps, the beloved writer, were being attacked and because of the things that they were supposedly doing. That creates just an incredible amount of bad will between those two, and we're going to talk next week about how that comes to a head, and how David Whitmer and others are instrumental actually in the siege at Far West. So as we move on then, one of the things that we're going to start to find is that back in Kirtland, the bank is continuing to fall apart. Again, Joseph and Sidney are only involved for about 6 months. They begin to pull out, which means that people who had invested money or believed that the bank was orders from God, because Joseph Smith had been involved in it, begin to rise up, and you start to begin to get this large-scale rebellion on the part mainly of the church leaders. About 10% of the members, but about two-thirds of the leaders begin to rise up, not just to talk back to Joseph Smith, but to angrily begin to institute an armed takeover of the temple and the things that are going on. Now, fascinating that in the middle of all this, in June, with this really starting to rise and what are we going to do here and all that, the Lord has his own elegant solution to what should happen. So at this very time, in June of 1837, Joseph Smith is inspired to do something different for the salvation of the church. At a meeting in the temple on June 4th, he approaches Heber C. Kimball, one of the Quorum of the Twelve, and says, in essence, "Brother Kimball, you've got to go to England and fulfill the mission of the Quorum of the Twelve is preparing for. But Brother Kimball, the Quorum right now is divided, and despite the difficulties, you're going to end up having to go alone." Now, Heber C. Kimball was planning on going. They had talked about a mission to England, but he was going to go as one of the 12, not the leader of that mission. Now, as you can imagine, this prospect frightened him. He felt uneducated. He felt unprepared. And he was believing that he couldn't do this alone. So he pleads, "Let me at least take Brother Brigham." Joseph's response, "No, I need Brigham here." And as it turns out, with everything that's going to unfold in 1837, he really did need Brigham Young there. Now, why is that important? Well, we know that Heber C. Kimball does go to England. He does take brethren with him. And that the converts that pour into the church, thousands and thousands and thousands of converts that will join coming out of England and out of Denmark, all over Europe, are going to come, and they're going to land about 5 years later, right as Nauvoo is trying to get started, and these English immigrants will provide the backbone to a vibrant, growing church, but not for 5 years. It's going to take a while for that to happen. So it isn't, interestingly enough, the Lord does have his answer and his solution to what was going to go on, but they weren't going to see it at first. Now, so what's happening here basically is a crisis of, who do I follow? Do I follow what seems to make sense financially, or am I going to follow Joseph Smith? And so here we have these contraries going on. Which one do we follow? Great quote here by Brigham Young. Listen to what Brigham Young said as he contemplated how to handle this. He says, quote, "I can tell the people that once in my life I felt a want of confidence in Brother Joseph Smith soon after I became acquainted with him." I love that idea of "I felt a want of confidence." But he goes on, "It was not concerning religious matters, it was not about his revelations, but it was in relation to his financiering, to his managing the temporal affairs under which he undertook. He could see that Joseph was not a good businessman." He says, "A feeling came over me that Joseph was not right in his financial management, though I presume the feeling did not last 60 seconds and perhaps not 30. Though I admitted in my feelings and knew all the time that Joseph was a human being and subject to error, still," Brigham says, "it was none of my business to look after his faults, and I repented of my unbelief, and that too very suddenly. I repented about as quickly as I committed the error." And then he concludes, "It was not for me to question whether Joseph was dictated by the Lord at all times and under all circumstances or not." Brigham Young took that to mean, I can see that he's going to make mistakes, but I'm still going to follow him as prophet, knowing certainly that he is subject to error and that he's not a very good businessman. And as it turns out, the Lord had told Joseph early on that in his temporal affairs would not be his strength. But he kept trying. It's one of the mistakes, I think, that Joseph made. The other that's struggling with all of this is Oliver Cowdery. Oliver Cowdery, who wrote the Book of Mormon as Joseph translated, Oliver Cowdery, one of the three witnesses. Oliver Cowdery, who had been the second elder of the church, was feeling pushed out of the first presidency. And part of it was is that he was starting to push back against Joseph Smith. And there were several reasons why he did. But I want to give one of them in this moment. Because in 1838, Oliver's actually excommunicated. And one of the first charges, he's charged, among other things, with virtually denying the faith. Why? By declaring that he wouldn't be governed by ecclesiastical authority in his temporal affairs. He was asked if the church or an ecclesiastical leaders offered guidance to organize your temporal life, would you submit to their guidance? His response was, no. I will not be influenced, governed, or controlled in my temporal interests by ecclesiastical authority or pretended revelation, whatever, contrary to my own judgment. Now, you might wonder where that's coming from. Well, remember that this is, again, Andrew Jacksonian America. And there is a strong belief in America's manifest destiny, where America is supposed to be and what America is supposed to do. And he's certainly a subscriber to that. Because listen to his statement. He says, I'm not willing to be influenced or governed or controlled, contrary to my own judgment. Such being still my opinion, I'll only remark that the three great principles, he says, of English liberty, as laid down in the books, are, number one, the right to personal security, number two, the right of personal liberty, and number three, the right of private property. And he continues, my venerable ancestor, he says, was among the little band that landed on the rocks of Plymouth in 1620. I am wholly unwilling to exchange his principles for anything less liberal, less benevolent, or less free. So Oliver is going to stand firmly, as did many Americans at that point in American history, he's going to stand firmly on what is then American values, that we're not going to be controlled by any religious body, but we're going to go on our own judgment, our own guidance, and our own counsel. So that's going to be the important element here. So as we get ready to talk about Missouri next week, what we're watching is two primary brush fires that are starting to spring up. One in Kirtland, where people have lost faith in Joseph Smith financially, and that's bleeding over into how they see him as a prophet. And now we're going to watch what happens when that bleeds over into Missouri, where now they're being attacked by old settlers, and they're going to have to make some decisions about past leaders and how they handle it. Brothers and sisters, our charge, I think, is that we're always having to weigh contraries. We're always having to weigh a number of items like faith and works, or the spirit of the law and the letter of the law. But one we may have to always wrestle with is our inspiration of the spirit and guidance in our life versus what we may hear from a leader who is also giving us guidance. And so often those are going to be in harmony, but we may run into times where they're really not, and they may be in competition one with another. When that happens, we are in the messy middle. we're having to decide which side to which we lean. And because we're trying to choose between two goods, not between two bads. This isn't opposition in all things. This is contraries where both sides are laudable, good ways to go, but we're going to have to decide under the circumstances which one do we need to lean on a little bit heaviest. And one of the hardest ones that I think we have to do in that regard is when we are hearing things from the prophet or maybe even from our individual leader, and we're having to make some decisions about how we're going to handle that. So my testimony is that what we see going on in Kirtland then in Missouri is going to reflect some of the struggles that we have in our own lives and how we handle it. I pray that we can do that and survive and thrive in the messy middle that sometimes we have to deal with. And I leave that with you in Jesus' name. Amen. And thank you for joining us for another Monday morning class. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions about future topics that we could discuss, or if you had any questions concerning something that you heard in the class, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you happen to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, please come in and join us on a Monday morning. We'd love to see you and identify who you are. If the podcast itself is resonating with you, go ahead and click subscribe so that Apple can figure out where we are. We'd love to hear from you. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll see you for another Monday morning class.